Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network. Hello and welcome to Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. I don't know about you, but almost every day I'm forced to remember a password or generate a code for something or other I'm trying to do on my computer. Luckily, computers are pretty smart these days and mine keeps all my codes stored for me. Passwords and codes are something we take for granted in the digital age, but such a new development. And today, we're going back to a time when making and breaking codes was an almost exclusively high-level military activity, most famously done behind the closed doors by the boffins of Bletchley Park. So today I'm joined by two people who are giving me the long view on codes and code breaking. It's the Bletchley Park military historian David Kenyon.
If you put yourself in the chair of the person at the other end and start thinking about how they behave and what they would do naturally, instinctively, what shortcuts they take, all of that, you can break their code.
And the Chief Information Security Officer at the BBC, Helen Rabe.
These days, passwords are ubiquitous. We use them in everyday life. To expect people to remember all these passwords, it's not possible. That's why we have password managers.
And before we get to that, Melissa, my producer, is here for a chat. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Tony. It's a really interesting thought, that, isn't it? That codes are quite a new development. I mean, was there a time in your life where you weren't using codes?
Well, codes aren't really a new development, you know. The first codes were around at the time of the Romans, believe it or not. But yes, it is true that the sophisticated coding that's happening now, really the birth of it was round about the beginning of the Second World War. And I'm particularly interested in it because near me, there is one of those English heritage blue plaques that says on it, Alan Turing, 1912 to 1954, codebreaker and pioneer of computer science, was born here. And I know just a little bit about Alan Turing, as most people do, but I don't know that much about Bletchley Park, and certainly not very much at all about the history of codebreaking. So that's what I wanted to find out about.
Yes, exactly. And we all remember Benedict Cumberbatch playing Alan Turing in The Imitation Game, which was incredible. But I feel like I could do with knowing a little bit more about the real history behind it. So I'm really excited about today.
We're always excited about the history behind things, aren't we?
That is Cunning Cast, isn't it, Tony?
Yeah, that's why we do it. David, before MI6, or I think it was SIS, wasn't it? It was originally called, before Bletchley Park. What did our armed forces do about codes and ciphers? Were they used much? Were they responded to on an ad hoc basis?
Well, codes and ciphers in military use, of course, go back for thousands of years. They go back right back to Julius Caesar. And the British were involved in it. I mean, there's stories about Queen Mary, Mary Queen of Scots, and all of those things. The Civil War, Napoleonic period, but it really gets onto a formal footing during World War I, and that's when the Navy and the Army set up their own code-breaking organisations. The RAF doesn't exist till the end of the war. And just after World War One, those two organisations are amalgamated into what's called the Government Code and Cipher School. It's not a school. It doesn't teach anybody anything. But that is the cover term for a code-breaking organisation that gets going in 1919 and indeed is still going today.
Nowadays, there's been a sea change, hasn't there, in our appreciation and use of codes compared with what was going on at Bletchley in the 1940s?
Well, I think they were the progenitor, weren't they, for modern-day cryptography, which we now know in our industry as encryption. And everybody uses in their everyday experience, so whenever you do online shopping, whenever you do a banking transfer, whenever you log into, you know, your bank and your apps, there is that little security logo on it. Please always use the security logo on the site. And everybody uses it in domestic commercial use. Nobody does anything these days securely without encryption being at the heart of everything they do. So it's no longer just used for codes and for military use or law use. We use those methods that were set during World War One and the good work at Bletchley Park for what we use in modern day, you know, everyday online use and digital use in our hyper-connected world.
Helen's just used the phrase, the good work at Bletchley Park. Two questions, really. First of all, they didn't know it was going to be that good, did they? And the second question is, why was Bletchley Park at Bletchley Park? It's like a funny little village just outside Milton Keynes.
It is. It wasn't then, of course, because Milton Keynes is younger than you and I. But as I say, the organisation that was created in 1919 is quite small scale. It's 100 people. And throughout the 1920s and 30s, it's reading other people's diplomatic telegrams and things like that. At the outbreak of war, or even before that in 1938, there was a perception after what had happened in the Spanish Civil War that if a war broke out, London would be bombed very heavily in the first days or even hours of the war. And so all government departments, including SIS, were looking for what they call war stations, places they could send all their various activities so they wouldn't get bombed. And it happened that in 1938, Bletchley Park was on the market, and Admiral Sinclair, who was C, if you think of M in James Bond films, that's actually C. Hugh Sinclair was C, and he spotted Bletchley Park and thought that would be a good war station for my codebreakers. So he bought the place, and this quite small team of, by July 1939, less than 200 people, moved to Bletchley Park. What they don't expect, of course, is how successful they're going to be and how many more people they're going to need and how many more buildings they're going to need and all that sort of thing.
You say Admiral Sinclair bought Bletchley Park. He actually bought it out of his own money, didn't he?
Well, there is a story that he bought it out of his own money. I'm not sure I believe it myself, because he died in 1939 and his sister, Evelyn, who inherited Bletchley Park, handed it over to the government for the cost of the transfer of title, which I think was 10 shillings or something like that. Admiral Sinclair had access to all sorts of secret government accounts, so he could get hold of SIS money very easily. But he wasn't going to write a check with, you know, Secret Intelligence Service written on it. So the title deed to the Bletchley Park has his name as a private individual, but I don't think that means he spent his own money. I think that was just to cover up the fact that it was the Intelligence Service that had bought it.
Let's suppose this is a movie. This is an opening shot, our establishing shot. Can you paint a picture for us of what Bletchley Park would have been like and what it was doing in 1940, 1941?
At the beginning of the war, you're looking at a rather eccentrically built country house from the 1880s with a landscape garden around it, a maze, fields of cows. There was no Milton Keynes, no concrete cows even. And there you have a team of maybe 150 very bright people working away, trying to figure out enemy codes and ciphers. Leap forward 4 years, 5 years to 1944, you've still got that mansion building and you've still got those geniuses, but surrounding it, you've got many acres of wooden huts, concrete bunkers, concrete office buildings, and you've got nearly 9,000 people, 75% of whom are women, all doing the same thing, but taking those genius ideas that the few people at the beginning have had and turning them into factory production lines of code breaking.
I've done a tour of Bletchley Park. There's a little lake there.
Yes.
Was that always there?
Yes.
So it's a really beautiful environment to just, if you need to, those little cabins are tiny and they have blackboards on every wall. So when they were, you know, decrypting and doing whatever, there are all these blackboards with chalk. It's very old school. But I also imagine a lot of it was
people walking around the grounds just trying to decompress and talk. And it's quite rural at the time. I mean, you talked about concrete cows. For those of you who don't know, Milton Keynes is famous for its concrete cows, but there was none of that around it. So it was quite rural at the time and quite isolated. Did they live locally or did and cycle in, or did they live on the premises?
No one lived on the premises.
Oh, okay.
Or the one or two families, the exception. Almost everybody, at the beginning of the war, they're billeted in local people's houses, in pubs, in hotels, wherever they can find. Towards the end of the war, the armed services have to build specific camps to put people in. But for a lot of the time, the majority of people are just living in the local community and commuting in every day. And as you say, they get to work, they go and work in blacked out buildings, often which are, you know, the concrete's barely set in some of them. For most people, it's very tedious work as well. I talk about the 75% of women. A lot of them were in this production line, code-breaking production line, where the jobs they were doing were not particularly stimulating.
Yeah.
And in many cases, people didn't have the big picture. They only saw the little bit of the job that they did. So they'd go in every day, they'd process these punch cards or these pieces of paper or this gibberish that they were given, and then they went home again. And if they were lucky, they went to the canteen and had dubious fruit tart with very little fruit in it.
The main house itself is quite ornate, almost over the top for the style. Mm-hmm. It had a very ornate ceiling. Was that just used by the officers?
In 1939, they try and squeeze the whole organization into the mansion and a few huts. But latterly, it expands out. And I make the analogy, often people have talked about Bletchley Park as being a bit like a university campus because it was full of people between the ages of 18 and 25, with a few more elderly, literally university dons in charge of everything. The other thing that's notable is if you go to any university in the country, the ornate original building just has admin in it and everything else happens in other buildings. That was true for Bletchley Park as well by the end of the war, that the mansion was senior figures' offices and common rooms and all the work was actually done out in the huts and the blocks.
David talked about the fact that London was vulnerable, so they spread stuff out. Is that true nowadays that our information, our tech, our computers need to be spread out, otherwise they're going to be attacked more?
I believe resilience is built into everything that they do today, technology being the core of it. But yes, there will always be that spread out, as you describe it. There needs to be contingency planning put into place.
How else can organizations make themselves resilient?
Corporate organizations?
Mm.
Well, I mean, most of them already do. They have backup sites. If the primary site goes down, a lot of companies now use the cloud, and even those cloud environments have redundancy backups. So resilience and recovery is a very strong part of modern corporate digital security. You know, you'll always hear somebody talk about incident management, respond and recover, and all the frameworks cover respond and recover. So what is you'll always be asked in an audit program, walk me through your resilience program. It's a big piece of work. And many people these days plan around the inevitability of a compromise. We build that in because it's very difficult to protect ourselves against it. The recovery and the response position to that is absolutely critical to bringing an organization back into play as soon as it's been compromised. So yes,
I find that really interesting because I think a terror for ordinary people like myself is that organizations will break down, that suddenly Facebook will turn on me or whatever. The idea that people have already recognized that this kind of thing might happen and are preparing for it to happen, in a way, is right, quite reassuring, but also quite scary because it means that there is possibly a kind of inevitability about these things happening.
Yeah, people often talk about it in terms of insurance policies. You plan for it. You hope it never happens, but you have that insurance policy in case you need it. It's certainly not an analogy that my industry is comfortable with, but you know, for the sakes of this conversation, I'll say that's very much how many see it. It's your insurance specs.
David, let's go back to Bletchley Park. I just feel as though Bletchley Park is a kind of beginning, and where we are now, Helen, is, well, not an end, but it is a mark of this huge transformation that's taken place. One of the things that in my research I've been able to discover about Bletchley Park is the high quantity and quality of the geekery around the people who were invited to go there.
Well, yes. I mean, one of the difficulties I have in my job is people ask me to explain how these codes and ciphers were broken.
Yeah.
And I understand it on a good day. I mean, my background is history and archaeology, not mathematics. But you have to remember that the reason these things were secure or important was because they were extremely difficult and you needed brains of the highest caliber to attack this stuff. fortunately, GCNCS had a network. I say an old boy network, and it was literally boys. It was very male dominated, but it extended into the universities, Oxford and Cambridge in particular. And Commander Denniston, who was in charge, was able to go back to King's College in particular, Trinity, Cambridge, these kinds of places, and people were tapped on the shoulder who were, and I don't use the term lightly, genuinely geniuses. Mm. The misapprehension slightly is that all of the thousands of people who worked at Bletchley were like that. A great many of them weren't, but it took the geniuses to come up with the methodologies, the ways of attacking the codes in the first place.
It wasn't just geniuses, though. It was kind of sub-geniuses, wasn't it? Is it true that people were approached who were very good at the Daily Telegraph crossword, that chess champions were recruited, that kind of thing?
There were some chess champions recruited. Hugh Alexander, famously, he was actually in Argentina at the chess competition in Buenos Aires when he was summoned back to the UK with Harry Golombek, who's another chess player who played at Bletchley.
It's a great start to a movie, isn't it?
Yes. The crossword thing is a bit of a myth, because we have two veterans, one of whom was asked in an interview, do you do crosswords? And he went, yes, I love crosswords. And he ended up at Bletchley Park. And another one was asked, do you do crosswords? And he said, no, I think crosswords are a waste of time. And he also ended up at Bletchley Park. So they did, a competition was run in the course of the war that if you thought you could do the crossword within 12 minutes, I think it was the Telegraph crossword, a millionaire paid for a competition and people were invited to send in their crosswords, and then they came to London for a competition and a winner was declared. But that wasn't intended as a recruitment exercise. It was only afterwards, when SAS got wind of it, they went, oh, there's probably some good, clever people in there. So a couple of people were recruited after the event, but they are the exception rather than the rule, if you like. So there's, like so many of these stories, there's a grain of truth behind it.
You're listening to Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. And today I'm cracking codes with two sensational cyber experts, the military historian David Kenyon and the Chief Information Security Officer at the BBC, Helen Rabe. Do you think the relationship now is between people with huge brains and computing?
So I think that there is a direct correlation. And I think the beauty these days is that geekery that you talked about is so readily accepted as being a cool thing. Mm. It's no longer judged as a, let me keep you in the back of house and never bring you forward sort of thing, nor is it, you know, a bad thing. It's fully embraced as part of our industry. There are brilliant minds who do modern cryptography and cryptography standards and the like. And I wish I had that kind of brain. I really do. But the education system now as well fully supports it. And there's also it's a lot less secret squirrel. I'll use that term. So even these days, the NCSC will run puzzles openly, publicly, and go, can you solve these? Or GCHQ will do the same. They'll put them out in the public domain and invite people to do them and bring them into the circle. So it's no longer so mysterious and secret. It's about finding the best people you can to help with this.
I'm so governed by the movie Oppenheimer at the moment that as soon as you start talking, I think of those kinds of brains. Do you think those people are slightly less exclusive, as it were, nowadays than they appeared to have been around the time of Bletchley?
I think these days, because I talked earlier about a hyper-connected digital world, that they can't be. There are some extreme subject matter experts, and they will stay in the domain of cryptography, and they won't move. I mean, the cybersecurity industry has so many tendrils to it. You don't need to be a deep technical expert. I'm certainly, you know, I'm technical, but not deep. There are subject matter experts within any industry, and we do have these in cryptography. They are no longer, you know, isolated. And are they? Some of them, yes, do have that reverence.
I can pick up on that, because I think one of the issues when you look at wartime cryptanalysis and the kind of people who are recruited, society is such that if you have a massive brain, your opportunities are limited unless you are, you know, from the right social classes and background. Mm. And so a significant number of people find their way into Bletchley Park because they went to Cambridge, whatever. But you do get people like Bill Tutt. He won a scholarship to his local grammar school. He had a very good maths teacher at grammar school. He went on to Trinity College, Cambridge, and he ended up at Bletchley Park.
And what did he do there?
He was one of the key figures in breaking the German high-level teleprinter system called Lorenz. It's sort of one rung above Enigma. Enigma's the famous one. Lorentz is the less famous but even more fiendish system. And he was instrumental in breaking that. And he's the rare example, if you like, of somebody who's come from a very humble background to be at Bletchley Park.
Yeah. What about Alan Turing? Where did he come
from? Alan Turing is more sort of civil service middle class. His father was an Indian civil servant. He went to private school. And so his path to King's College, Cambridge, was more expected, if you like.
But what was it he actually did? What is he important and celebrated because of a thing that he contributed?
The thing about Turing is he's such a multifaceted individual that he's famous for all sorts of different things. But the thing that I think is fascinating about him is he sits in my world, Bletchley Park, but he also sits absolutely in Helen's world, because if you look at his On Computable Numbers paper that he published in 1936, he was saying very profound things about computing, yeah, which continue to be absolutely relevant today. And again, in 1950, he was one of the first people to talk about AI on the radio. He actually gave a public lecture on the BBC entitled Can Machines Think? And so I like to look at his code-breaking career, which was quite short. He was only at Bletchley Park from 1939 until 1943, as kind of a side diversion from his main preoccupation, which was mathematics and computing. And so there are many people who worked at Bletchley Park who went on to be very famous for other things. And it's only when you go to their Wikipedia entry, it says, oh, worked at Bletchley Park. People go, oh, that's interesting. I think Turing, had he lived longer, would be much, much more famous for his contribution to computing and AI than perhaps he would be for code breaking. I think his code breaking might be more of a footnote in his biography.
Helen, you're nodding and smiling like he was your dad.
Oh, I wish I knew that much about him, but he was a forefather, you know, and if you look at the conversations now around AI, you hear his name pop up more often than not. You know, and we have the Turing test as well, and all those sorts of things that come into the computing universe. He was multifaceted.
Can either of you explain to me what the Turing test was?
The Turing test is, he set up an imaginary scenario where you take an observer, a person, and they sit in front of two screens or whatever you want to call it, or passing slips through a piece of paper through a slot or whatever, doesn't matter. And behind one screen is a human and behind the other screen is a machine. And the observer is allowed to ask any questions they like. And their challenge is to guess which one is the computer and which one is the human. And Turing hypothesized that computers will eventually reach a point where you can't tell which is which. So that's if a machine can pass the Turing test, it can imitate a human on what Turing described as quite a basic level, just sort of a text interaction. Actually, every chatbot we go on when, yep, you know, we've got a bill that's wrong, or, you know, our parcel hasn't arrived, is, well, a lot of people would argue they're failing the Turing test because you know straight away that it's a bot. But it's, like many things that Turing described, it's actually quite confined and well-defined, but it opened up a world of sort of an imaginative world, if you like, of what the possibilities were.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? I always feel this when you discover that people who were around 70 or 80 years ago were predicting things which are central to our ordinary discourse as human beings.
The other person who's important in this story, which we alluded to earlier, was Donald Mickey, who was also at Bletchley Park and went on to be a very profound thinker in AI. He made the prediction that robots would take over. He's one of the first people to make that prediction. But he predicted it to be a utopia where we could all just lie in bed all day drinking beer because the robots would do everything. It's only somewhat later that people kind of went, are you sure about these robots? You know, do you trust them? And he changed his view later on. But again, Bletchley Park forms this melting pot of brains who you can connect all these people together. And you mentioned Oppenheimer. If you look at Cambridge and Princeton and MIT and then the Manhattan Project and Bletchley Park, you can draw a connected network. All these people knew each other.
Yeah.
And all of them were sharing ideas and bouncing off each other. Claude Shannon, who invented the bit, Max Newman, Turing, they're all in this sort of milieu that starts in the 1930s and is kind of interrupted by the war. They all go off and either build bombs or code break for 5 years, and then they get back together again and carry on inventing the modern world.
We've just been talking about blokes nonstop for the last 10 minutes.
But it was a sign of the times, you know?
Yeah.
That was a sign of the times, but we had all those women supporting at Bletchley Park because the men were in the war.
And the women who were supporting, that it wasn't, a lot of them were very educated too.
Yes, extremely bright women. And, you know, they had the opportunity to step in and support.
There are a number of women who are in the pre-war organisation. When Denniston recruits, he sort of doubles the size of the organisation in 1939. There are women on the list there as well, a few. But you have people like Margaret Rock, who she got a degree back in the 1920s when it was quite rare for women to get degrees. And then she went to work for the Board of Trade, as was, doing analysing import and export statistics. But then she came to Bletchley Park and started doing cryptanalysis with Dilly Knox, who's one of the most famous code breakers at Bletchley Park. And he was dying of stomach cancer, so he got iller and iller. And she spent more and more time kind of sitting by his bedside and communicating what he wanted done to Bletchley Park. But when he finally died, she was so clued up, she basically took over. And she was still at GCHQ into the 1960s. She was a fundamental cryptanalyst at GCHQ. Mavis Lever became Mavis Beatty, is another one who went on after the war to work for GCHQ in code breaking and was extremely successful. There's a famous document written after the war which tells you everything you need to know about Enigma, which is known as Beatty, Beatty, Rock and Twin, like a sort of firm of solicitors. And that's Mavis Beatty and her husband, who she met at Bletchley, and Margaret Rock and Peter Twin. So two men and two women.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, this is Tony Robinson bringing you My Cunning Cast. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave a rating or a review. And do take a look at our back catalogue. There's a growing selection of shows there to keep you company. Everything from Census, Coronation, Nights, What the Past Smelt Like, loads and loads. You're going to find something you like, aren't you? What is the difference between codes and ciphers, or is it just two words for one thing?
Depends who you ask. In the Royal Navy, a code was used by other ranks and a cipher was used by officers, which is no help at all. But ignoring the Royal Navy, the general consensus is that a code is where you use words or phrases or numbers to mean something else. A cipher is where you take the actual text, the letter, the alphabetical letters of a message, and you then garble or swap around. So if you can either transpose the letter, the position of the letters, so you can jumble them up, or you can actually change the individual letters to a different letter. So technically a cipher uses the letters and a code is, as I say, words and phrases in a dictionary.
And what were the codes or ciphers predominantly that Bletchley Park was dealing with?
It's dealing with both, because most of the ciphers, well, there are some key cipher systems that Bletchley Park is attacking during the war. The Germans use two main ones, which what's known as high-level ciphers, which are Enigma and the Lorentz teleprinter system that I was talking about. The Japanese have a number of cipher systems, particularly for their diplomatic traffic, which is really important because the Americans and the British can read it from fairly early in the war. But the Japanese also use a code book system in the Pacific for the whole war. And huge numbers of people, both at Bletchley Park and in Washington, D.C., are involved in unpicking that code system. It uses five-digit numbers to represent words and phrases. So both systems are being attacked on quite a large scale.
I tend to think, and probably this comes out of the movies, that there were the Germans doing codes, and then there were the Brits and the US doing codes kind of together, but getting on each other's nerves as well. Is that basically true?
It's basically true. I mean, one of the real success stories of Bletchley Park, in contrast to the Axis powers and Germany in particular, is that they they are prepared to collaborate. And a collaboration is established with the Americans in 1941, in the winter of 1940-41, which was kind of a surprise to all parties because there wasn't a lot of trust before that. And Britain had been spying on the US in the 1920s. So it was quite a revolutionary thing to do. But what it means is by the time you get to 1943, 1944, the landings in Italy, D-Day, these kinds of things, the two countries are completely integrated. They're sharing intelligence, they're sharing code-breaking skills, they're trading hints and tips, if you like. And what's really striking about that is in 1945, they don't stop. You'd have expected, well, even the senior politicians expected that once the war was over, everyone would go back to doing their own national thing. But the personnel at the professional level, both in the UK and in the US, were like, no, we've got to keep doing this. And actually, they still do it to this day. The Yakuza Agreement is still in force. And
we have Five Eyes now as well.
Five Eyes is basically Yakuza plus Canada, New Zealand, Australia.
Yep.
Does it do much?
Oh, yes. So if you look recently, there was a ransomware gang, Lockbit. So Lockbit is a very prolific ransomware gang, and their site was seized by the lawmakers. And that was a collaborative effort between intelligence agencies across the US, here in Europe, UK. And they share all this intelligence because there are no borders in cyber. So that intelligence sharing is absolutely key when it comes to organized crime, nation states. So it's still very much in use.
So you get danger from organized crime and nation states, mm-hmm. perceived crime by the other side. Do individuals and individual hacking become a threat, or are they just an irritant?
There are levels. It depends. I mean, you know, with the sophistication of computing and also the business model of organized crime. So you can buy ransomware as a service. It's very organized. So if you want, you don't have to be a sophisticated hacker. You can go and buy ransomware as a service off the shelf, if you will. And you can become an irritant as an individual. But we you know, the challenges around the attribution of the individual, because there's so much pseudonymization and so much, you're hiding who you are as an individual. It's very difficult to track down the individual in question. A lot of resources, a lot of money get expended finding people specifically one-on-ones. Often it's individuals attached to organized crime gangs. Nation state, well, that's a different league. That is up to the intelligence agencies and all the machines that sit behind that. Getting to terms with intelligence sharing, which groups are we talking about? Where is it coming from? Which quarter? Which nation? So attribution is very difficult because you can hide so well on the dark web. But, you know, if somebody, we used to have this problem with script kiddies, is what we called them, which were teenagers who decided that they would test their hacking skills against somebody like, you know, the NSA. As also, it can be a very ego-driven behavior. And so, you know, we don't laugh at them, but yes, that irritant can be quite disruptive.
We at Bletchley Park nowadays, cybersecurity for us, even as a museum, is a big deal for us. We have to make sure our data is secured remotely, all of the other things that any normal company would do, and we're vulnerable to all of the same attacks. Mm. But ironically, we're also subject to a layer of attack from the sort of the vanity hackers you're talking about, simply because we're Bletchley Park.
Yep. Mm.
They forget that all of our computing expertise was 80 years ago, and now we're just a normal museum. You know, they think that somehow, you know, we have iPads in some of the galleries to provide interactive content, and regularly, you'll find those iPads aren't working because someone will have deliberately hacked the pad just because to show that they can.
Yep.
You know, and it's a pain. It's a low-level thing, but it shows that aspect of the psyche you were talking about. But also, we're also under attack by people who simply want to steal all our money. So
yeah,
that's a much more serious issue.
Yeah. It you know, if you've got a brand that's of value and a public taking down could be embarrassing for you, yes, that's more than an irritant. You know, it depends on the intention behind the individual. I mean, the hackers come in shades of colors now. It used to just be black, white, and gray. It was the good old days. We've got blues, we've got reds, we've got greens. It comes in variations.
I don't know what you mean.
We talk about black hats and white hats, right? So the white hats are the good guys. The black hats are the bad guys. It goes back apparently to the etymology. It comes from the cowboy movies. Remember the spaghetti Western movies with, you know, good old Clint Eastwood and everybody else, where the bad guys would always wear the black hat and John Wayne would wear the white hat. So that's where it comes from. But then at some point we introduced the gray hats. The gray hats are like
hacktivist groups like Anonymous, who will go and decimate the Ashley Madison site, for example, years ago, because they believe that site just shouldn't exist. So they have this sort of vigilante type behavior. But, you know, to you, the hacktivist, that might be legitimate. To the person on the receiving end of that, who admittedly is having an affair, the damage you cause is not justified. So, you know, the greys, the hacktivists, it depends on which side of the fence you sit as to whether or not their behaviour is.
Let's just spool back for a sec. Tell us about Ashley Madison. I don't know.
This goes back to, I think, 2014. Ashley Madison is the illicit encounters website. It advocates infidelity and it was compromised and the data was removed and then it was publicly leaked. So when that happens, it was publicly leaked on the surface web. That meant there were husbands and wives everywhere suddenly discovering that their partners, their husbands and wives, were customers of the site. It caused absolute devastation for some people. I believe that there were some suicides as well. So that's greys, right? They believe their cause is just, but you as a victim of that cause will not think the same way.
So they're the greys. Who are the pinks and the reds and the blues?
Oh, reds and greens and blues. Let me see if I can remember my colors. So the reds are, you go back to that vanity conversation you had, reds will go for other hackers. They'll test their mettle. They don't like that group. And the problem is that spills over into you. That spills over into our industry. You know, when they're going for each other and taking down server farms to prove a point with another, you know, red hat group, it causes a knock-on impact to day-to-day life. There's a spectrum of colours when it comes to hackers now.
Let's go back to the slightly simpler times. So what was it that Bletchley Park was hacking and how did we win?
Well, hacking is a very good word because all of the systems that Bletchley Park was attacking shared common characteristics, really. And you can describe that by, if you imagine machines communicating with machines, you can build very secure systems that allow a machine to communicate with a machine. The problem comes when you put humans in the mix. I describe it as putting meat in the sandwich. You can rely on those humans to behave inappropriately. And that means making mistakes, taking shortcuts. In some cases, they're taught wrong behaviors. And this comes under the modern umbrella of human factors, but it was absolutely true in the Second World War. One of the examples, a very simple example, is for an Enigma operator to send a message, he has to come up with three random letters of the alphabet, a bit like a password.
Let's just in parenthesis, because we haven't talked about this yet, remind me what Enigma was.
Enigma is a cipher machine that looks a bit like a typewriter, and it doesn't transmit messages. All it does is encipher them. And so a German wireless operator would write out the message he wanted to send, and then he would key in the letters of his message into the Enigma machine. And as he pressed each letter, a little light would come on with a different letter. And that's basically the encipherment. He'd write that down. And then he'd send that using Morse code, tapping away, did-da-did-da-da, to the guy at the other end. But the point is, in order to do that, he had to set his Enigma machine to a specific position. The components can be moved around to create different encryptions. And he had to choose a particular position to start the message. And he also had to tell the guy at the other end which start position he'd used. If it helps, there are 103,000 million, million, million possible start positions. So it's quite a big choice. But part of that process, that operator has to choose three letters of the alphabet and then send those three letters of the alphabet to the guy at the other end. And he uses that to set up his machine correctly. If you ask humans to come up with three letters of the alphabet randomly, they simply can't do it. They use the alphabet in order. They use QWERTY off the keyboard, they use verticals, diagonals, they use swear words, they use their girlfriend's names, they use their dog's names. Exactly like we do with passwords nowadays. Or they just use password.
Password,
yeah.
Yes.
And so one of the things Bletchley Park was able to do was attack exactly that and find out or guess the predictable behaviours that their enemies would use and thus compromise the system. Mm. Dilly Knox, who was the chap I was talking about who died in 1943, very perceptive man, he described this with a question he used to ask his new staff. And he would say, which way do the hands go around on a clock?
Clockwise.
Not if you're the clock.
Oh!
And the point about that is if you put yourself in the chair of the person at the other end and start thinking about how they behave and what they would do naturally, instinctively, what shortcuts they take, all of that, you can break their code. And that's a gross simplification of lots of very, very complicated techniques. But at heart, they all come down to this misapplication of what, when correctly used, would be a very secure system.
Okay. Nowadays?
These days, everybody has a password for something. It's just passwords are ubiquitous. We use them in everyday life. And people are creatures of convenience. All right. To expect people to remember all these passwords, it's not possible. That's why we have password managers. What I do for a living is not what you do. It's not what you do, Tony. I think in a secure fashion. And I then, and I see this in our industry, we project that onto everyday people, as in people doing jobs that are completely unrelated to security, and expect them to think it's common sense not to use your first name and your last name as your password, or your date of birth, or those sorts of things. But these are the convenience parts that people just defer to because they have a mindset of, it'll never happen to me, number one. Number two, it's easy to remember, and there are so many. That's why people also use the same password across multiple sites, right? Which then, you called it meat in the sandwich, right? Here's the challenge. When an attacker manages to compromise a company and steals all those passwords and login details, it then takes that list and it sells it. And I am being simplistic, but for the sake of this conversation, let's keep it at this level. That attacker then goes and sells those details on the dark web to some buyer, all right, who will then take hundreds of thousands, if not in some cases, millions of login details, draw up an algorithm, and let's say they'll go to a company XYZ, and they run it against that company's login interface, right? Because it knows that a lot of these people actually use this company. So it'll take all those credentials that have been stolen, it will run it against this company's login, and it'll get a tick in the box for every password and login detail that matches that login attempt. That's why if you use the same password across multiple sites, it can do that.
I absolutely understand what you're saying. Mm. But I feel I'm being told off.
That's not the intention.
Surely it isn't just a question of we have the same passwords out of convenience. I have probably, I don't know, 50 or 60 different applications that I use that require passwords. Mm-hmm. I haven't got the brain that would allow me not only to remember what those passwords were, but which application they apply to.
That's why we encourage people to use password managers, because it does it for you. This is the day and age we live in. This is the problem. Everybody, to your point, you have 50. Nobody can expect you to remember that. This is the challenge with passwords, is because we expect people to not use them time and time again. We expect them to be complex. We expect them, as a security industry, to have all of this discipline. But they're only human. And this is why we then have to push people into using things like password managers and taking the discipline, because the password manager will create a complex password for you. And the next time you go and shop on site XYZ, it'll remember it from your previous use and say, would you like to use that?
I was just going to take that back to the Second World War, because the man operating an Enigma machine, the German wireless operator on a U-boat in an army unit, wherever he is, he's not a cryptanalyst. He's not a code specialist. He's a soldier who was taught Morse code, and then he's given this thing that looks like a typewriter and told, encrypt your messages using this. He's not told, he's never heard the number 103,000 million, million, million. He's completely unfamiliar with how codes are broken or anything else. He is just an ordinary citizen like you or I, who's been given a piece of kit and told to use it.
Yeah.
And so it's really quite unfair to say that man is an idiot or
irresponsible
or whatever. He's been given kit that isn't his job to understand. And the burden really is on the people who supervise him or manage him or train him to give him enough information to remain secure. What's interesting about Enigma is that the German Army and Air Force systems are broken in January 1940, very soon after the war starts, because they have this little element of human predictability built in. The German Navy recognize that, and they issue all of their operators with books of genuinely random settings, which they then have to use. And Bletchley Park still break that by a different methodology, but it takes them another year and a half. It's not until the summer of 1941 that they break that. And that's because the people in charge of the Navy operators have recognized a bit of human weakness and solved that problem. But to put the burden on the operator is, like you say, kind of unfair.
Yeah. if you've got something like your iPhone, it'll show you in your password manager how many times and where your password has been compromised and recommend you change it. We're getting better at designing around this challenge that people have, which is the inability to cope with the overwhelm of password responsibility.
We've been talking so far about Bletchley Park as though it was the British who broke the German codes. But there were other countries involved in it, weren't there? Am I right in saying that the Poles made a big contribution?
Yes, the first people to read German military enigma are a team in Poland. That's partly because when Poland is sort of recreated after the First World War, and the Polish immediately recognised that both the Germans and the Russians are going to want their bits of Poland back just as soon as they get the chance. And indeed, that's what happens in 1939. So they've got a very profound reason to be wanting to read German messages as soon as possible, which the British don't really have. In the 30s, certainly, we're not really interested in Eastern Europe that much. It's not really our big problem. So Britain isn't really looking at Enigma, military Enigma. But the Polish team get involved with it very early. Polish government, actually, they go to Poznan University maths department. And the virtue of that maths department is Poznan used to be part of Germany until 1919. So till the Treaty of Versailles. So most of the people there speak German as well as Polish. So they're ideal. They're bilingual mathematicians. And they run several sort of exam-based competitions. And they pick three chaps who they think are the top of the cream of the crop. And indeed, they prove to be, because they attack German Enigma and develop methods of reading it before the war starts. But what they rapidly realize is the Germans, Enigma isn't static. The Germans change their procedures. And they don't remodel the machine very much, but they add bits to it and they change their procedures as time goes on. And so the Polish realize that they're not going to have the capability to read this stuff in large scale, especially if they get invaded. So in the summer of 1939, they invite both the British and the French codebreakers to go to Warsaw, and they basically lay it all out, say, this is what we've been doing. It's an entertaining story in some parts, because Dilly Knox, the codebreaker I told you about, who'd been banging his head against military Enigma for ages, he went to Poland and the Poles told him the answer to the bit that he'd be banging his head against the wall for. And his response wasn't happiness, it was furious. He was in a taxi with Denniston afterwards, shouting and raving and going, how did they possibly work this out? I couldn't work this out. You know, they can't have possibly worked it out. But they had. Actually, what it was there's a bank of wires in an Enigma machine that go into 26 holes. And the question was, which hole represents what letter of the alphabet? And Knox was scratching his head and going, oh. And he went to Poles and said, what is it? And said, well, they start with A and then they go B, C, D, E, F, G all the way around.
Oh, good grief.
Which was the one option that he hadn't thought about because it was too straightforward. It doesn't make any difference to how successful the encryption is. It's not a fault with the machine or so. But yeah. So the Polish contribution is really, really important in the early days. And that first break that I talk about in January 1940 is using a method that the Polish have devised.
Helen, nowadays, are there particular nationalities, particular people who are very skilled, very advanced at cybers and cyber breaking?
Personally, from my side, I would say no. I'd say we're all on an equal footing, but that's what we know. It's the bit we don't know that I can't talk to. So we have our own GCHQ here. In the donut.
Well, so we haven't talked about GCHQ, have we? It's a direct descendant, isn't it, from Bletchley?
It's the same organisation. Yes, yeah. They in 2019 they had an exhibition in the Science Museum to celebrate their centenary from 1919. So you have to think about it, starting in 1919, being in London up until 39. It goes to Bletchley Park till 46. It goes to Cheltenham in the 50s, and it's still there. Yeah. And now they're opening up in Manchester as well. So it's this, and I talked about Margaret Rock, some of these other people, they stay in the organisation right through the Cold War, and so it's basically the same outfit.
But GCHQ is as much about commercial activity now as it is about...
No, I'd say the NCSC is more about the commercial and the face-off into the commercial sector.
NCSC?
NCSC, the National Centre for Cybersecurity, which is an arm of GCHQ. I'd say GCHQ is still very much an intelligence organization, very government-centric, and it has a public face, but it also does obviously have the less public face that nobody knows about. When I would say they're all on a footing, the international intelligence agencies, and they, you know, from an allyship standpoint, the Five Eyes, they all communicate amongst themselves. You know, we see enough going on for us to say confidently that the skills are there. The takedown recently of Rockbit, the ransomware gang, shows you that that allyship works. But just as we have our skills, you know, those we consider the enemy have theirs.
We've talked up till now as though Bletchley Park was kind of a beginning, and where we are now is, I suppose, a kind of end. But before this conversation started, we started, Helen, you and I started talking about this concept of quantum technology.
Oh, yes. That's another. Alongside AI, there's a lot of talk going on in that.
What is it?
It's modern computing on steroids, is the very simplistic way I'll say it. It's hyper-processing. So we consider computers these days, and I don't know what the processing speed is, to be extremely fast. But, you know, with the encryption methods we have today, with the modern processing, it can take years because that's how effective modern encryption methods are. With quantum processing and quantum computing, the anticipation is that will go from years to hours because of the processing speed you can put through at the quantum level. The challenge you have is that the only quantum computers that are readily available are in academic research institutions, some government, I believe. It is not commercially available. And current estimates don't believe it'll be available for another decade. But it's certainly not something that people in our industry are complacent about. It's just that we're wary, right? We have a tendency in the technology industry to be quite hyperbolic with things. I mean, you look at the inflection point with AI last year with ChatGPT and how hyperbolic that conversation has come with everybody worrying about a Skynet equivalent. But, you know, when it comes to quantum processing, that's very, very intensive to do, you know. Quantum computing will not be environmentally friendly. That amount of processing power to do that will take a lot of energy to produce.
We look at the punch card processing was done at Bletchley Park. They had an entire building dedicated to these Hollow Earth punch card machines, which are sort of proto-computer data management processing systems. By 1945, they were using 2 million punch cards a week, 6 tons of punch cards, and they had women 24 hours a day punching holes in the punch cards to capture all of this data that they use for code breaking. And it's an enormous effort. But then I did some simple arithmetic on the calculator on my phone to work out how much data that actually represented. And you could probably fit all of the data from Bletchley Park, certainly all of the punch card data, onto my iPhone about 10 times over. And that's the leap we have made in a lifetime, not my lifetime, but a lifetime.
Yeah.
And so it's hard not to argue that maybe not in 10 years, but certainly, you know, in our grandchildren's day, if we had any, we will have made another
quantum leap. Do you want to go there?
I wasn't going to go there, but yes.
Helen, how compromising do you think quantum computing is to cybersecurity?
It poses a threat. How could it not? The notion of something that can break encryption in hours as opposed to years and using current modern crypto methods is a terrifying thought. But by the same notion, there is the balance that we could utilize that as an opportunity, i.e., you know, do we have quantum processing for our own encryption methods? And therefore, we fight fire with fire. So it almost becomes, I think, a type of arms race where who gets to it first? Do they start to break us first? Or do we actually manage to be able to create significantly robust post-quantum cryptographic methods that are more resilient, and then also use the quantum processing to our advantage? So, you know, give and take, I would say, Tony.
I think Helen is right about the arms race, that if you look back through the history of cryptography, cryptanalysis, it's always the case that people come up with what they think is an impenetrable system, and then someone devises a way of breaking that system, and then they come up with a better system and a better system still. In every case, it's utilized the technology of the day. You could argue there will always perhaps be a balance, and on both sides, it will take the best brains we have, either for or against, to fight that war.
We're seeing a very similar situation right now with AI technologies. We know that AI technology is a threat to us in the security industry, but we're also leveraging AI technology to fight that threat. So that give and take That's how it's, I think it's always going to be the same with quantum.
We don't have to fear the tech. We have to fear the people who are using the tech.
It's always the intention.
If I would ask you both one question, and I always ask this question about a cunning plan, so I'm sorry about this. Melissa insists that I ask this question.
I love it.
If you, as someone who wants to protect us against being hacked, could come up with one cunning plan for the future, what would it be, Helen?
Oh, wow. On the spot. Thank you, Melissa. If I could protect everybody, what would I would, and hopefully we're not too far away from this, do away with passwords and find a way for us to secure people's online digital presence without the need for passwords.
Coming to you, David, let's go back to the beginning of time. How cunning a plan was Bletchley Park? And can you have seen the possibility that they wouldn't have been able to crack the German code?
It's never a done deal. One of the things that's striking about Bletchley Park is once you get into the nitty-gritty of these systems, arguably there are things the Germans could have done, not easily, but with a bit of effort, which would have shut the Allies out from reading all of that traffic. And this is what happens in 1942 when they introduce a four-rotor Enigma for U-boats. And Bletchley Park can't read that traffic at all for 9 months, although you do get back in. So it's quite conceivable that Bletchley Park would have failed, you know. Well, not failed, but they would have had nothing like the success they'd had. That has ramifications right across World War II. And this is leading me towards there's a thing that crops up in all the newspapers which really bugs me, so I'm going to get it off my chest now. People say about shortening the war by 2 years. Bletchley Park didn't shorten the war by 2 years. That's a counterfactual that Harry Hinsley came up with a few years ago. But it certainly speeded up the process. It didn't speed up the process of dropping atomic bombs on Japan. It didn't speed up the progress of the Russians westward. So in the big scale of things, you can't argue for that. But it certainly speeds up the Western Allies' effort. One Bletchley Park historian put it, he said, had it not been for Bletchley Park, the Western Allies, the British and the Americans, would not have met the Russians on the Elbe River in East Germany. They would have met the Russians either on the Rhine or at the Channel, and they would have stayed there.
A great place to end. Helen, David, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
If you want to join in the conversation, you can find me on X at Tony Robinson, and you can follow all our podcast news on X and Instagram at CunningCastPod. And please don't forget to follow this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. I'm Tony Robinson. This is my Cunning Cast, produced by Melissa Fitzgerald, and it's a Zinc Media production.